Advertising your business with GCN is simple, effective,
and more affordable than you might think.
Visit advertise.gcnlive.com for more info. Take your business to the next level.
Paracast, the gold standard of paranormal radio. And now, here's Gene Steinberg.
We have a really special guest on our show this week, someone who has had so many professional credentials the mind boggles. He's Richard Thiem, and he has a website, ThiemWorks.com. That's Thiem with T-H-I-E-M-E. And we're going to cover his recent books. One called UFOs and Government, an Historical Inquiry, and some novels in the series called Mobius. All right, so we got a lot to go with. But when I was looking up your background, Richard, I noticed that you kind of got started in writing as a teenager, writing sci-fi, and you wrote a story called Pleasant Journey for Analog Science Fiction, which is one of the famous sci-fi magazines that was edited by Joseph Campbell. Was that John Campbell, right? Not Joseph Campbell, right? John Campbell.
You're right. Joseph Campbell. Right.
So you got, how did you start writing sci-fi? And what was the story about, by the way?
Very interesting question to start off with. I started writing when I was like 13. We have time, so I can do a very brief autobiographical statement about that, how that happened.
Take your time. If we okay. run over time, I'll throw you off. Don't worry.
Okay. When I was, 13 years old, I was in eighth grade at Nettlehorst Grammar School in Chicago, Illinois. Now, what's relevant is that I had no father after the age of two. My father dropped dead when I was 2 years old, unexpectedly. And my mother, who had met him at work, not uncommon, think of Mad Men, had to go back to work. I was what they called a latchkey kid before we had that term. And all the teachers then, to think back to that early era, were women. I never had a male teacher until eighth grade when a teacher named Ted Besser was my instructor. And he asked us all to write a novel. Well, I took him at his word. I wrote about a 150-page novel, kidnap story. He asked me if I'd seen a particular movie that was playing then. No, was the answer. And he said, this is really impressive. I realized everybody else in the class wrote one or two pages and called it a novel. I wrote a novel. He told me he took it to his master's that he was taking to get a graduate degree to show them the quality of my work. Why is that relevant? Because without a father figure, that was the first time a male figure in authority affirmed that gift. It wasn't affirmed at home. That was a family that thought accounting and law was the best route for a young guy in Chicago, but not me. My inside said something else. Because of the way I grew up, I seriously think I lived in books. I read a lot. I had a great imagination. And because he affirmed that, it meant so much to me to have someone say, what you're doing is good and it's worthwhile. So I start writing stories. Not every teacher could follow that. In high school, I remember being told, you wrote something I don't understand at all. I don't know what that's about. And back home as a family, I got things like, oh, another story about an adding machine marrying a typewriter. And then everybody would break up. So you learn, as a lot of us do, to fight with resistance against that which denies your internal structure and yearning. And so I did. So I wrote stories. And I wrote Pleasant Journey, and I sent it off to John Campbell at Analog, and I still have his letter, because that was a very big deal. He was a grandmaster of science fiction and had brought out Analog to the top of the pile. And what the story was about was, in effect, virtual reality. It was about someone who invented a machine that he was trying to sell to a carnival that you could enter and put on the electrodes and the headphones and all that. And you would enter a dream world that seemed so real that you didn't want to leave it. And that's exactly what happened to the carnival owner when he tested it. He wanted the machine at once, but he didn't want to get out of the machine because it was so preferable to his mundane life. Well, that was, let's see, I say I was 19, so that would have been 1963 when I wrote that. That was a long time ago, a long time before virtual reality was a word either, a term. But that's what I was seeing. I always have been able to see the future in a way much, much more clearly than I joke that I can see the present. I don't even know what I'm having for dinner tonight. But when I look out, connecting the dots, intuitively understanding where things were likely to go, which stood me quite in good stead, and I can talk about how that led to my work as a speaker and writer for the last 30 years.
When you talk, of course, about living in this virtualized world, I also think, of course, as Star Trek's holodeck, of course, there you don't have to put anything on. You just enter this room, and everything
right
there is 3D. And even there, they want to stay sometimes. And sometimes the machines
yeah
don't work, so the prohibitions against killing you are turned off, and that makes for a good episode.
Yeah, to be completely honest, because I decided, how am I going to talk for 2 hours with these great guys about this? And the answer was with honesty, with complete honesty. Just go where it goes. And the truth is, I never watched Star Trek. I haven't seen a Star Trek movie to this day. That's a shameful thing to admit, but there it is. So I know about things like the holodeck because everybody talks about them, but I've not seen the series or the movies.
Well, we had a couple of times on the show a producer named Tracy Torme, who actually was one of the creators of the holodeck. He's also involved, of course, in studying UFOs and the paranormal.
Okay, yeah, I was just saying, I know who that is, Tracy Torme. I know who he is.
All right, so let's go on this path now. You get this story published in Analog. Did you get other stories published over the years?
I went on a completely different route. I'll try to keep it brief. I mean, I wrote a novel, but when I graduated from Northwestern, I loved literature. I loved words. I loved good literature. And I was good at it. Once you loved something, I was a Phi Beta Kappa, and I graduated summa cum laude at Northwestern and went to the University of Chicago in literature on an NDA Title IV fellowship. And it wasn't work. I just loved it. But when I got out, I taught in college. I taught at the University of Illinois in Chicago for 5 years. I taught literature and writing. And I wrote a novel, and it took 4 years. And I look back at it, and it was really good. But what happened is pretty typical. In those days, you sent the whole manuscript or a carbon copy. You know, that's where CC comes from. A lot of people don't know that. To a publisher, and you could only do one at a time, and they got pretty dog-eared, and Putnam's was a major publisher then. We hadn't consolidated like publishing has today, and I still treasure a letter from the vice president telling me he had read that novel with pleasure and admiration, but then he added, you know, it wouldn't be a commercial success, and that was true. So I went through a lot of changes, and living in England, I had lived in Spain earlier, and I lived in England, outside of London, and I went through a lot of changes and joined the Anglican Church and came back and became an Episcopal clergyman. This was a pleasure for my family, too. They were half Christian, half Jewish. So this was the Christian half manifesting itself, and there are a lot of internal reasons why you do that, and I'm not going to go into all of that, but it was clear and sincere. And a meaningful transformational moment, actually it wasn't a moment, it was a couple of years of a process where I did explore living in England, what you would call the paranormal. I found a wonderful house that was a used bookshop, and one room was nothing but the Society for Psychical Research books published at the turn of the century. You know, all those great, great books. You know, by really, really terrific people.
And we'll get back with Richard Thieme telling us about how he got from there to here, and it sounds like a fascinating story as well. With Gene and Tim, you're in
The Paracast.
Hey, listeners, I want you to have the entire Paracast experience, so I'd like to tell you about After the Paracast. After the Paracast is an exclusive feature for subscribers to the Paracast Plus. With After the Paracast, you never know what's going to happen next. After the Paracast features color commentary, special interviews, and further conversations with Paracast guests. With Paracast Plus, you can download a very special enhanced version of the Paracast also. We do offer exclusive music, videos, and more features are coming. To get more info about subscribing, please visit theparacast.plus. Once again, theparacast.plus. Prices are just $1.50 a week, less than a cup of coffee at your local convenience store. Check out theparacast.plus to learn more about Paracast Plus.
The Silver Lungs Generator is the only all-encompassing professional class product for producing endless colloidal and ionic silver solutions right from the convenience of your home. With recent regulations threatening the sale of silver-based supplements, now you can secure yourself and your family by producing your own silver solutions anywhere, anytime. You can have the peace of mind knowing that you can create endless supply of silver anytime, anywhere, for any application. The Silver Lungs Generator is a one-time purchase that requires no maintenance nor replacement parts for the life of the unit. This product was designed to be an invaluable part of your vital preparations. For a detailed report on the differences between ionic silver, colloidal silver, and what most silver solution manufacturers are producing, please visit our website at www.silverlungs.com for more information on why you should be producing your own silver solutions right from your home forever.
We depend on our drinking water supply daily, but where does that water come from? Your water provider encourages you to get to know your local water source so together we can protect and preserve it. The investments we make as a community to protect our water source now ensure we have a sustainable drinking water supply for the future. Visit drinktap.org to learn more. This message is brought to you by the American Water Works Association and your local water provider.
Let me tell you a story about Bill. Bill was a normal guy in his 50s. He had back surgery about 2 years ago. Bill was in a lot of pain. He dealt with his pain by taking the Percocets his doctor prescribed for him. Bill took more and more and more of them to help with the pain, until one day the prescriptions weren't enough to get rid of Bill's pain. Then one day Bill found someone to help him get rid of the pain with illegal drugs he didn't need a prescription for. Fast forward to today. Bill lost his job and his family. The only thing he does have is his drug dealer. If you know Bill's story and you don't want to end up like Bill, call the Detox and Treatment Helpline right now to get away and get treatment.
800-296-1327. 800-296-1327. 800-296-1327. Call right now. Help is standing by. 800-296-1327.
What if you could cut your heating bills this winter with your existing wood-burning fireplace and not spend thousands doing it? You can with Great Wall of Fire Fireplace Grates. Our U.S.-patented, made-in-America Wall of Fire Grates increase fireplace efficiency, eliminate fireplace smoke problems, and come with a 30-day money-back guarantee. See our grates in action and get free shipping from walloffire.com or call 800-274-7364. Fireplace heat without fireplace smoke. Walloffire.com.
We'd like to hear from you. If you have a comment or question about the Paracast, send it to news@theparacast.com. That's news@theparacast.com. And don't forget to visit our famous Paracast community forums at forum.theparacast.com.
We continue with Richard Thieme, Chapter 2. You went to England. What year was this now?
I lived in England in 72, 73.
So you were at the tail end of the British rock and roll revolution then?
Well, what I was aware of was that it was a welfare state. a very dreary place compared. I mean, Thatcher hadn't come on the scene yet and turned things upside down. It was pretty great, but I loved England, and all that work in English literature had taught me to love and appreciate the landscape and just the whole ambience. That's one of the reasons I became an Anglican, I'm sure, because between the professors and my immersion in the literature, it transformed the way I thought about things, the Anglican ethos and the Anglophile ethos. And I finally made the decision to become Episcopalian. I came back to this country and became an Episcopal priest. And I did that for 16 years. The point is that exploring all that stuff, what we call the paranormal, I hate the term because it's normal, so much of it. It's consciousness and the ways it works. But reading people like Frederick W.H. Myers, Apparitions at the Time of Death and things like that, William James, that was part of my experience, as well as I got to know people in that world at the Spiritualist Church, and I knew mediums. And I knew all sorts of people who were exploring. And obviously, from my childhood, where I needed to create a life and an identity and an understanding and do so, above all, with imagination and words, you know, there's a way that becoming an Anglican fits that bill. And I explored automatic writing and I explored other things. And finally, that led to my decision to visit the parish clergyman and say, I'm ready to be baptized. He says, well, no, you gotta do something. I said, I'll do whatever I need to do. Let's do it. And I came back to this country and what jobs in the church paid. And they said, just priest. And I said, well, priest it is then. And they said, that's not how you discover a vocation. I said, it's how I do it. And the bottom line is a few months later, I was in seminary. And of course, I was obviously a good student. And I immersed myself in 3 years of that. And then I was really good in parish ministry because I was extroverted and loved it and loved serving people. And part of the transformational journey was to discover that I needed to be grounded in the universe, in the world, in a different way than I had been. And that transformational, what I call a hierarchical restructuring of the psyche, is what others sometimes call a conversion experience. But I think it's hardwired into all forms of human consciousness. And different religions take different metaphorical paths to trying to articulate it for its adherents and then nurture it and teach it and sustain it. But it's really the same kind of journey. It's hardwired in your brain. And I had that experience in England. But because I was so experientially based, I continued to pursue it. So the bottom line is I did that work for 16 years. And after about, I don't know, 13, 14, 15 years, the itch to write again really was compelling, really compelling. Two relevant anecdotes here. One, when I decided I wasn't going to make it as a writer because I couldn't get that novel published, I took all the notes for a second novel, which was A Story of Transformation, and I dumped it in the dumpster, and I can tell you that I heard a voice. Now, I'm not saying what the voice was very easily. Could have been my unconscious. The voice said, now just wait. Now just wait. Now, I did. And I did ministry, as I say, for a total of 16 years when I left. But the bottom line was, I think an awful lot of writers write a great first novel, and then don't have anything else to write because everything they have lived to that point is there. And unfortunately, the publishing industry pressures them to do another one and another one and another one, and they often fail. They fail to produce quality work in the second or third or fourth because that pressure doesn't serve them well. So I think that I lived life the way I did, working in ministry, and the challenges of it, and I did it very creatively on the island of Maui, in Salt Lake City, Utah, and then finally in Milwaukee. That led me to the point where I just wanted to write again, and I started a short story. And the short story was science fiction. It was about an encounter, a very unusual kind of encounter with alien life, and who they chose who the aliens chose for the encounter, which was a very atypical sort of encounter story. And I wrote it, and I had a draft of it, and I guess I had the guts to find out where John Updike lived, and I sent it to him. And I said, look, please help me. I believe I want to write again. I don't know if this is any good. Can you give me an opinion? And I still have the wonderful letter that John Updike sent back. You know, we all have our personal saints that live in our memories in lighted niches. And he's sure one of mine. He said this. He said, I'm reading science fiction lately, and this is right up there with the very best. Do not quit. And he gave me some other advice. And when he came to Milwaukee later to do a lecture at the library, I could tell him what he had meant to me. I've tried to find that eighth grade teacher I mentioned and haven't been able. He's probably long dead now. But I wanted to tell him what he meant to me, because teachers don't know when they say something offhand how a student might be hearing it and how life-changing it can be. But I took Updike at his word, and the point is I really developed that story into a very, very good one, and it actually figures in one of the novels that we're going to talk about. And then I got involved with the UFO group. That's a whole other thread, but I want to stick with, you asked why I turned to writing short stories, or did I write other short stories? And that came about later, after I had worked with people in the intelligence community. And one day, this is a true account, the assistant deputy director of the National Security Agency said, with kind of a chuckle, he said, you know, you can't ever discuss what we talk about in here. And I said, I know that. And he laughed and he said, unless you start writing fiction. He said, fiction is now the only way you can tell the truth. And I took him at his word, because when you work collaboratively in security, I mean, I've keynoted security conferences in 15 different countries, and you get to know people. You just as in the ministry, you do not betray their trust, or in the intelligence community, you do not betray sources and methods. Because a lot is at stake. So I took in his word, and I started writing short stories. And I have written 27 of them, and they were collected in a volume called Mind Games, and 19 of them were. And a number of them are dealing with aliens or science fiction tropes or deep states of consciousness.
We got so much more with Richard, Gene, and Tim. You're in
the Paracast.
Thank you for listening to GCN. Be sure to visit GCNlive.com today.
If you're concerned about the power grid and want to generate your own supply of off-grid electricity, this will be the most important message you'll hear this year. Here's why. We now have a small number of solar generators back in stock. These emergency backup systems provide life-saving backup power when you need it most. And unlike gas generators, solar generators run quietly, emit no dangerous fumes, and produce an endless supply of free electricity from the sun. Whether it's wildfires, dangerous weather, power grid issues, or just getting off the grid, you'll never have to suffer through painful power outages again. Even better, all this week, radio listeners get over $700 in free off-the-grid bonuses, too. Go to MySolarBackup.com to learn more and check availability. That's MySolarBackup.com. Look for the free report, Crisis Cooling, how to make absolutely sure your meat, milk, and medicines stay safe and cool in any power outage. Yours free at MySolarBackup.com.
USA News Update. The White House is approving an emergency arms sale to Israel. According to the State Department, the U.S. will sell roughly 14,000 tank artillery rounds to Israel for just over $106 million. The agency cited a provision in the Arms Export Control Act that allows it to bypass Congress in approving the sale. The release said the State Department notified Congress an emergency exists that requires the immediate sale of the arms to Israel. The president of the University of Pennsylvania, Liz McGill, is resigning following a congressional hearing on anti-Semitism on college campuses. The House investigation, which also includes Harvard and MIT, was prompted by university president's failure to explicitly condemn calls for the genocide of Jews. McGill announced her immediate resignation on Saturday, while Harvard president Claudine Gay has apologized for her response during the hearing, emphasizing that threats against Jewish students have no place at the school. Skip Kelly, USA News.
All right, crew, let's get her dug.
Honey, you want to give me a hand? I'm planting that tree, remember?
No matter how large or small your digging project may be, no matter how urban or rural, you must always call 811 before any digging project. 811 is our national one-call number, alerting your local utility companies to come out and mark any lines they have near your dig site. You must call 811 at least 2 to 3 business days before any digging project, so you can avoid hitting our essential buried utilities. This includes natural gas and petroleum pipelines, electric, communication cables, and water and sewer lines. So before you do this or this, make sure you do this. For digging projects big or small, make the call to 811. Brought to you by Common Ground Alliance.
It's obvious. The unthinkable continues. Most Americans know something very wrong is happening. People in charge keep telling you that everything's fine and to stop noticing. But you know better. That's why self-reliant folks are investing in emergency food storage. And you should, too. My Patriot Supply, the nation's largest emergency preparedness company, are the ones you can trust. Go to MyPatriotSupply.com and secure their best-selling 3-month emergency food kits. Each contains tasty breakfasts, lunches, and dinners averaging over 2,000 calories per day. Save $200 on each 3-month food kit you purchase. My Patriot Supply also sells solar generators, gravity-powered water filters, off-grid room heaters for when the power goes out, heirloom seeds, and survival gear. Order by 3 p.m. and your items ship that same day and arrive quickly on your doorstep in unmarked boxes. Go to MyPatriotSupply.com today. Time is running out to prepare for what's coming. MyPatriotSupply.com.
This is Leslie Kane, and I'm with the Coalition for Freedom of Information, and you are listening to the Paracast.
Richard, before we go on, I was going to ask you here. We're jumping from going back to short story writing to working in the intelligence community. In what capacity? How did that begin?
Well, it began when I left the ministry, and I left the ministry because the cognitive dissonance was getting so great. I don't want your listeners to think that, I jumped on the secretary or something. What in fact happened is the technological revolution happened. The internet revolution happened. And I had bought my son an Apple II when he was 12 years old. We played an Infocom game. Do you remember Infocom? The great interactive fiction. And one of them was a wonderful construction of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. You know, these were on floppy disks, right? Green screen, all big caps. And we were playing that wonderful interactive fiction game. And this is the epiphany I had. As I described, a text-based guy. I knew how literature worked. I knew how words worked. I knew how narratives were constructed. This was different. This was an interactive fiction that, when I played it with my son, led to the light bulb moment when I said, wait a minute, this isn't like just reading. This experience with the computer in and of itself is transformative. And it is not only changing my brain, I think it's changing me, who I fundamentally am. And then the next idea, which came right away, was if that's correct, if that's happening to me, it's going to happen to the whole society. It's going to happen to the whole world because everyone in those days, you thought, is going to be with a computer. Now everybody's computerized. Everybody's going to be in front of a computer, I said. Everyone is going to be a digital extension of the transformation of their consciousness through this internet and digital revolution. And I don't want to miss it. And that was the bottom line. I wrote an article called Computer Applications for Spirituality, the Transformation of Religious Experience. Pretty far out, but damn right on. Nobody would publish it. Sent it to the best Anglican Theological Review, and they sent it back with notes in the margin saying, he must be crazy, or who does he think it is, or this is insanity. I'm not kidding. 10 years later, they published that very article and wrote to me saying, we'd like to publish it now. It's so cutting edge. Well, it wasn't cutting edge 10 years later, but it sure had been cutting edge. And people who find that article still say, my gosh, you saw it all from the beginning. And that's what the illumination, what the epiphany gave to me. I saw what was going to happen to society. And I tried to write about it to the religious community of which I was a part, and nobody knew what the hell I was talking about. They just couldn't get it, literally, as I said. So push came to shove when I was being offered the jobs I always thought I wanted, the biggest Episcopal churches in the country and a bishop. They were on the table. And I knew if I took one of those, I would be handcuffed with golden handcuffs for the rest of my career because they paid for ministry really well. There are a lot of perks. That's a whole other story. And so I made the difficult decision at the age of 49. No, I think I've got something here. I'm going to speak and write to the issues that I tried to address in the religious context, but they apply to everybody. And I need to find the audiences that need to understand what's coming. And so I resigned from the ministry, and I began a career of speaking and writing, and that was 30 years ago. And I did that full time. And you probably get the idea. I throw myself into whatever I do. I'm still doing it. I love what I'm doing still all these years later. And I start writing. And technology was the major focus. Now, that was 1993. And what's significant about that date is that was the first year it was authorized to do commercial activity on the Internet. It had been prevented before that. It was only military or academic or corporate. And so suddenly there was an audience. There were audiences everywhere who wanted to know what that was about. The Wisconsin Professional Engineers Association said to me, they called me and they said, we're hearing about this thing called cyberspace. Nobody knows what it is. Can you write a 1,000-word column on what is cyberspace? So I did. And they loved it. And they said, would you write another one next month. And pretty soon I'm writing columns that I called Islands in the Clickstream. In other words, we're all jumping into the digital clickstream, and these were islands of reflection into the deeper aspects of the technology and how it was impacting and transforming us.
Now,
yeah,
the wider Internet, I understand, but up until then, especially from the 80s and early 90s, we had proprietary online services that basically kept you within their own networks, like AOL and CompuServe,
right,
and Genie. And I was very active on,
yep,
AOL. In fact, I worked for them for a number of years. And then eventually they expanded into what we call the wider Internet. And then the individual service was no longer relevant because you could communicate with anyone. Things that you were writing about. Right. Go ahead.
Right. And that's right. I was on CompuServe for a long time. And Usenet groups emerged. So I was plugging into what we call, if you remember, bulletin boards. I wrote for some of them. You know, you just go where the technology leads you. And that was really the core of my insight. What this technology is going to do is reframe identity and therefore possibilities for action in every area of life. And people don't know it. And because, as I said, I was a text guy, I happen to be positioned on the cusp. You know, it's like looking at the Terminator on the moon. You know, if it's all light, you don't see anything. If it's all dark, you don't. But it's a Terminator. You see mountains and craters and rills because the illumination is revealed by contrast. And I was in a position to say the printing press world is not going to persist in the way in which it has for about 400 years. And a new digital means is going to come to be. And because I had been in the religious world, I knew that was the story. It's speech made religions possible. And then writing transformed oral religions into written religions. And then the printing press did it again. And I was saying, and the digital world is going to do it again. So I was getting involved. Hacking was different then. You know, it was brand new. And I was plugged into some of the people who were doing hacking, and I was writing articles about this. My first one was for Wired magazine. But for others, they were all over. And that was another example of the advice I could give people on how do you do this thing. I had written this piece for Wired, 5,000 words, and they took 500 and printed it. And I said, can I do something with the rest? And they said, sure. And it was about how the Internet was going to change things. And I'm sitting in front of my old AT, IBM AT, thinking, well, where can I sell it? I don't know any other magazine but Wired. And then the light bulb went on, duh, you know, like Homer. Don't just write about the Internet. Use the Internet. And Gopher was our go-to search engine then. Within a couple of weeks, I was selling articles to England, to Australia, and to South Africa, which would start regularly reproducing my Islands in the Cook Stream every month for several years. And I built up a whole credibility through what I was publishing elsewhere. And I had the idea, email was pretty new for most people. I offered those columns I was writing to friends, and they said, sure. So I would attach them or print the text in the... There were no blogs, but I started sending out the columns. USA Today found them and told people about them, and then hundreds. But within a few years, I was sending that column to 60 countries and thousands of people. And it was about technology, and I was expanding my sense myself as a person. And that example I gave is use the technology. Whatever it is, engage with it, because you can't think in terms of the paradigms created by the other prior technologies, how the new technologies are going to transform you unless you engage with them and allow them to do that transformation. And then you go where they take you, and that's what I did. Suddenly I'm world renowned.
We're going to continue on his discovery of the cutting edge there. Richard, Gene, Tim, you're in.
The Paracast.
Thank you for listening to GCN. Be sure to visit GCNLive.com today.
If you love mysteries, you'll love these two books by Tim R. Swartz and Sean Castile. In Mimics, The Others Among Us, you'll learn about the strange beings that can look like us, but are not. In Alien Artifacts, Incredible Evidence of Exotic Material from UFO Encounters, you'll see the hard evidence of UFOs that has been ignored or even hidden. These books will definitely blow your mind, and both are now available on Amazon.com.
First came Attack of the Rockoids, and it was a critically acclaimed success. And now there's The Coming of the Protectors. A former military intelligence man is contacted by a space woman in a dream. A dream that turns out to be a nightmare, because evil forces on her distant planet are planning to conquer the Earth. This is gripping science fiction of the classic kind. Attack of the Rockoids and The Coming of the Protectors. Find out more at Rockoids.com. That's Rockoids, Rockoids.com.
Do you know someone with a drug or alcohol problem? Get help now. Insurance may cover everything. Stop the drug and alcohol nightmare. Call 800-284-0523. Learn how through the Family Medical Leave Act, you can leave your job without losing your job. Locations everywhere. Get immediate help for drug and alcohol problems. Call now. 800-284-0523. 800-284-0523.
Silver has always been nature's very own antibiotic, and only one system allows you to produce an endless supply of nano-sized silver solutions right from the convenience of your home. Silver Lungs. With the addition of our unique lung delivery system, respiratory infections are targeted directly, where traditional oral administration simply cannot reach. This pioneering method also preserves the original particle sizes and delivers your silver solution directly into the bloodstream. See the Silver Lungs generator and lung delivery system at silverlungs.com. That's silverlungs.com.
Get healthy, not high, with 100% pure CBD powerful natural pain relief from Veterans Vitality. GCN listeners, have you ever thought about how CBD may help you? I'm sure you have heard about the many benefits of CBD. Well, here's your opportunity to try before you buy. Created by veterans and for everyone who deserves better choices, our CBD is derived from organic hemp, grown in the USA, and third-party tested. Veterans Vitality CBD saves you as much as 25 to 50% over our competition, and a portion of all sales is contributed to veteran nonprofits and events. Many of our customers have experienced improved quality of life, help with anxiety, PTSD, and overall well-being. Our products do not contain THC. They are safe, non-addictive, effective, and 100% legal. GCN listeners, get your free trial bottle of premium CBD by simply paying shipping and handling at GCNFreeCBD.com. That's GCNFreeCBD.com. Again, GCNFreeCBD.com. Offered by Veterans Vitality Premium CBD.
I had no idea it would destroy my life, but before it happened, I had a successful business in Austin, Texas. Everyone laughed at me when I shut that business down, but I could not ignore the wake-up call. I was volunteering on a project to get locally grown food into a school. That project was a complete failure, and I discovered that there were few local farmers. There's only 4 days' worth of food in the grocery stores, and everything comes 1,500 miles via a just-in-time trucking system. I lost friends and family who told me I was crazy to worry about that, but I kept at it. I'm Marjorie Wildcraft. Those of us who know what's going on in the world know you need to become self-reliant before the dollar collapses. I've created a free webinar at gcnfood.com. I can show you, like I've shown hundreds of thousands of people, how to grow lots of food, even if you have no experience, you're older, or you're out of shape. Do it now, before the stores are boarded up and food is not available at any price. Go to GCNfood.com. GCNfood.com.
Hey, this is Marie D. Jones, the author of This Book is from the Future, and you are listening to the Paracast, the gold standard of paranormal radio.
Richard Thiem, before we get on, I wanted to go back to one thing. I don't think I understood the answer, because we see you covering technology. And I also did some columns for USA Today back in the early 2000s, particularly on personal computers. But I still can't understand the intelligence thing, how you got involved with
these intelligence agencies. I'm getting
there. Okay.
Just about to go there. The point is, I got in connection with all these people. I'm on these Usenet groups, and Jeff Moss had founded DEF CON. In 1993, you know, it was 100 guys who came out of the bulletin board world, and he said, let's meet in Vegas. 100 guys at DEF CON 1. By the time he got to DEF CON 4, it wasn't huge. There were 300 and something people total. And he put out a word that I got saying, I need a keynoter for this conference. So I wrote to him at once, because I jump on these things right away and say, look, this is what I do. This is how I can be valuable. And I can help these younger hackers understand what is happening, because they don't have the context they do. I'm a middle-aged person. And Jeff's genius was then and now to give people a chance to do that. And if it worked, then he did it again. Well, it worked for me. Last year, I spoke at DEF CON for the 26th straight year, except now there's, what, 30 to 40,000, not 300. I connected with people out of multiple personas. But what I had brought into that work from the ministry was respect, empathy, understanding, and they got it. Kim Zetter, who's a journalist, said the first time she heard me at DEF CON, she said, what I got was they got that you respect them. And these are people who didn't get much respect in those days. They hadn't become multimillionaires yet. You know, they were blue-spiked kids, you know, with a lot of metal in their heads. And doing interesting, innovative things. And I saw who they were. And I told them at that first DEF CON in 1996, you are going to be the thought leaders in the 21st century. Because, see, I knew that on the basis of what I knew. And they didn't know it yet. Well, when I saw a whole loft on stage a couple of years ago, and I saw these people I had become friends with who were in the loft, who had become multimillionaires and had built the industry and were the thought leaders in it, Mudge, you know, Peter Zatko, said to me, he says, I remember when you said that 20-odd years ago. I was one of the ones who knew what you meant. So, first DEF CON, DEF CON 4, 1996. Yeah, a lot of hackers. I was also approached by people covertly there from the CIA. And I also met people who became some of the best, closest friends I have ever had in my life from different agencies, but especially the NSA, because that would be tied into what we're talking about. And by virtue of my connection with them, we developed collaborative, complementary relationships over the years. I don't need to go into names. I just say that they literally became my best friends ever because we talked about everything. We understood the nature of the world of intelligence. And I understood it because it was not all dissimilar from the personas you present in ministry in order to facilitate conversations and elicit information. In ministry, you do it in order to support the autonomy and the power and the agency of the person. But a friend of mine at NSA, senior guy, he said, yeah, we do it in order to control people, both inside the agency and out. So same technique, but with a different end. So that's how it began, that I became close friends to people and was invited into conversations and invited over the years to do some specific things for this or that venue, which I did. And above all, it was the relationships. And I would stay with these people when I went to the fort, and we would talk into the wee hours. And by virtue of what they must have found in me as a friend, just like in the ministry, they felt they could talk about things that they didn't know who else they could bring those things to. And so I'm just saying, after 30 years of that, and as I said, going all over the world to do keynotes and getting so connected to people, I've done 8 or 9 trips to Netherlands, 5 to Australia, then Tokyo, Israel, Dubai, Malaysia. These people too became close friends. And that's really the whole story. To bring who you are, I brought who I was to them. And when there was mutuality and reciprocity and value was exchanged in both directions, then the relationship really worked. So that in a, not a nutshell, but that is how I got to connect with people and my whole career and my whole life story. If you've seen the segments unfold as I described them, it's been the generosity of strangers and one thing leading to another. One thing after the other, opening up or leading to another. And that's how I got involved. And we haven't even talked about UFOs. That's relevant as well. And as well as the fiction, you said you wanted to discuss the novels, because those are detailed illuminations in fiction of the life of an intelligence professional, as I understood it. And they've gotten tremendous reviews from people inside defense for speaking with a voice of authenticity that they themselves are prevented from using. So that's the long answer to your short question.
So how early on was the intelligence community aware, like you, of the whole paradigm shifting of the internet and the whole digital revolution?
Yeah, it's a great question. And You know, you're talking about tens and thousands of people in 17, 18 different agencies. So, I don't have the audacity to speak for the whole community, but I can say my observation was that it happened the same way Hemingway, when he was asked, how do you go bankrupt? He said, 2 ways, gradually and suddenly. And that's kind of the way it happened. You know, these are people who are, they're not imprisoned, but they're assimilated by their culture. As everyone is, the paradigm becomes a prison, and we are the guards. We who hold that perspective are the guards preventing the paradigm from opening doors and windows. And that's just not uncommon. It took a good while for it to be understood, but it did happen. I can't put a timeline on it. I can give you an example. I was doing a talk for the there's a guy, the special agent in charge of the Chicago office, the FBI, was in the audience, and I was describing what had happened as a result of the revolution. In other words, porous boundaries, which meant information moved across what we had thought were firm borders before, because now the technologies brought down those borders, made them porous and amorphous. And therefore, information could originate anywhere and go anywhere. And everybody knows that now. But at first, it was very hard to get a hold of that. And I was describing that what that meant is that people might still think their behavior is determined or influenced or inflected by the sources of power and authority of the prior paradigm, but it's not anymore. And I gave obvious examples, like Apple or, pick one, any transnational company that when people work for it has more influence on who they are, their identity, and how they act than the country of origin. You know, now we know, I had a friend go to Davos not long ago, and they said, you know, I didn't talk to one person who referenced a country. But they referenced this kind of Lando Calrissian cloud city they've built where it has its own laws, its own offshore ports, its own means of doing business, its own accounting, and its own extraordinarily lucrative support system for all in it. And it's not me. It's probably not you, but it's them. And that was emerging, alternative worlds that had more power and influence on fundamentally who we were, that identity question I raised in the first place. And this FBI guy got up and he said, bingo. And I said, what do you mean? He said, we used to go to people to collaborate with us, and we could count on their cooperation because they were good patriots and they're doing it because they wanted to do the right thing for America. Increasingly, he said, what they say to me back is, I'd like to, but. And that but is the key thing. But I am influenced more by something other than patriotism. I'm influenced by the real source of my monetary value, my work, my vocation, my career, and it's not located in any particular place. Or if it is, it's modular and distributed.
We're exploring the entire world here with Tim, Gene, and Richard. You're in
the podcast.
Thank you for listening to GCN. Visit GCNlive.com today.
Hey, listeners. I want you to have the entire Paracast experience. So I'd like to tell you about After the Paracast. After the Paracast is an exclusive feature for subscribers to the Paracast Plus. With After the Paracast, you never know what's going to happen next. After the Paracast features color commentary, special interviews, and further conversations with Paracast guests. With Paracast Plus, you can download a very special enhanced version of the Paracast also. We do offer exclusive music, videos, and more features are coming. To get more info about subscribing, please visit theparacast.plus. Once again, theparacast.plus. Prices are just $1.50 a week, less than a cup of coffee at your local convenience store. Check out theparacast.plus to learn more about Paracast Plus.
Have you heard the warning from the Dead Doctors Don't Lie guy? I'm talking about Dr. Joel Wallach. He says if you have a 4-inch medical chart, if you take prescription drugs for high cholesterol or high blood pressure, arthritis, joint pains, or other health issues, the medical profession is failing you. They're using you for an ATM machine. That's what he says. He has a free lecture revealing what pharmaceutical companies don't want you to know. There's been groundbreaking research and discoveries on how to effectively treat or eliminate over 900 different diseases naturally. And it's all in his free lecture called Deadly Recipe. You want it free? Call him toll-free at 855-79-YOUNG. You ready? 855-79-YOUNG. Dr. Joel Wallach, the Dead Doctors Don't Lie guy, says there's no reason why we shouldn't live to be at least 100 and have a great time getting there.